Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking hybrid vehicles today and various fuel technologies with Glenn Bauer, Senior Scientist in Mechanical Engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Really pleased to have Glenn with us today. And certainly if you have some questions, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Glenn, great to have you back.
No, thank you, Larry.
And especially since, you know, you're leaving for India today.
That's correct. So
yeah. What are you going to be doing over there?
Well, part of my, well, as you do at the university, you have to consult if you actually want to make a living at this. So we're working with Tata on trying to do a low-cost hybrid bus solution over there.
So the Tata Nano...
Well,
Has been on your radar screen for a bit.
Well, actually, their engineering facility is in Pune, which is kind of the middle of India, a little bit east of Mumbai, which most people know where it is. And so I actually saw the Nano before it actually even got released and what they were doing. And so I was basically, the head of engineering was there, so he kind of gave us the spiel on what they did to reduce cost and such. But in India, they're selling it for 10,000 rupee. That's without air conditioning, and that's about $2,000. So to bring it in the States, they'll have to do some more engineering work as far as to meet our crash-worthy standards and such. But it's a very small car. The tires are about the size of something you'd see on your, you know, a small trailer.
Well,
it's all weight. Yeah. You know, it's all weight, and it's a rear engine car.
Yeah.
So it's if you look back, it reminds me sort of a VW, the old traditional bug. It's kind of like that, you know.
Okay. And that's about what the old traditional bug cost in the U.S. back then. But, of course, the Nano was about $2,000, as I remember. But the Nanos here will sell probably for around $8,000, I think they were talking
yes,
about.
Yes, probably.
And they'll, as you say, they're going to have to do some re-engineering in order to make it worthy. Road-worthy in terms of our standards. Well, Jim in Rhinelander has a question for you, so let's go to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I'm in the market for a real small cars. Most of the week, I only drive a few miles, you know, but on weekends, I like to get out of town a little bit, and I've been looking at some of the hybrids that are out there, the Prius, and I'm looking at the Toyota Yaris, the Hyundai Accent, and the one I kind of fell in love with was actually the little smart car, and I believe that they are coming out with either a hybrid or a full electric car. Give me your opinion on that smart car and the latest on the technology, where that's going.
Okay. I'm familiar with the fact that they were going to have an electric version. I haven't read up on what will be involved as far as the powertrain for the hybrid version of that. But the smart cars are coupled with Mercedes. And so in Europe, the diesel engine is actually, I believe, a Mercedes diesel. So you've got some good engineering behind that car. So how far are you? Is he still online?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How far are you traveling as far as you said short distances during the week?
Yeah, maybe I'm only like a mile from work, you know, but I live up north. So I'm trying to micro-size my life. You know, I want to. I got a little inflatable kayak, and I'm just trying to get as much mileage out of a vehicle as I can, and you know, mm-hmm. do some rustic camping. So I do travel quite a bit on the weekends. But I tried this out down at Bergstrom in Milwaukee, off of Good Hope Road there,
mm-hmm.
and I was really impressed with it. The engine they use in the States here is a little Mitsubishi, 70 horse, 1 liter, I believe, and 4 valve per cylinder. And, man, it had more power on the highway, on the interstate, actually, than any of the other cars I tried. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, one of the issues that the hybrid people are having is that when you go very short distances, because you're heating up electrical components as well as the engine, they're not very efficient in the wintertime in, you know, sub-5-mile distances. And so mm-hmm. if you actually talk to the engineers, they're like, it's like that's one of their worst applications to try to meet the customer's demands, because you're heating the engine up and the electric motor and the batteries all at once. And so that, I mean, if you're really only going to commute a mile, that may be one of those where you want to, you know, actually look at maybe an extended range pack that's available and do the EV only, so you don't have to try to start the engine just for that 1 mile distance.
Sure. What is your rating on that little smart car. What do you think of it?
Well, I've traveled in Europe and seen a lot of them there, and I mean, talking to some of the colleagues I have in Europe, I haven't really heard any negative aspects to the smart car.
I would expect probably the one thing would be crash.
Well,
worthiness.
In the United States, people think more about that. In Europe, the drivers are much more precautious just because there is the large semi, and then there's a lot of these, subcompact vehicles on the road just because fuel is so expensive in Europe.
Yeah.
And so over there, they're better drivers because there's a larger mix, and they know the consequences of an accident, and then they're just...
So they're more careful.
Yeah.
All right. All right, there you have it, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Fond du Lac, we turn to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I have a Prius, and I've always been curious, does the gasoline engine ever directly drive the drive wheels, or is the motive power always from the electric source? In other words, does the gasoline engine turn a generator, which then furnishes the power to the motor, the electric motor, which would then drive the wheels all the time?
Okay, that's the quick answer is yes, the engine does drive the wheels directly. it's called a power split is what it is. And so what there is it's actually a combination of three inputs, and you have to balance basically the torque from those three different demands. One of them is to the wheels, one of them is to a generator, and then one of them is to the engine. What happens then is there's a balance between those three, but at road speeds, when you're cruising down the highway,
60 miles an hour,
yeah,
or something,
they're trying to take all the power directly from the engine to the wheels. They may have to use a little bit to balance that. There's three inputs. You got to make a balance of it. So
sure.
they may be taking a little bit off of that engine as far as electricity to balance the third input so that you can continue to go down the road.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions as we talk hybrid vehicles and various fuel technologies with Glenn Bauer from the College of Engineering here at the UW-Madison. Pleased to have him with us today. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or email us at talk@WPR.org. And as long as we're at it, of course, we have a 2010 Prius, which is going to be recalled pretty quickly here. What are your impressions and thoughts about the situation with Toyota, its troubles with its accelerators and its brakes and
yeah.
so forth?
Well, just one quick input on Tom that just called in. The fact is that using electricity, motor and a generator as basically a torque converter, which is what we call it, is not very efficient relative to like the torque converter and manual transmission. So that's why we're trying to use the engine directly to the road if we can. Back to the Toyota then. People don't realize that these vehicles are, at some point, they're going to approach like the complexity of a fighter jet, that you as the driver are just putting electrical inputs into a computer. And so if you don't do enough, if the engineers don't have enough time to test it, don't have enough time to develop it, then we're kind of getting into this realm, I believe, where there's some small nuance that they never thought would occur they didn't even think to test it.
Yeah.
And yet, it for some reason, it's occurring, and it's occurring more than once. And we're getting these bad situations occurring because of it. The military, obviously, they get hundreds of millions of dollars from the government to develop it and to test it. And they typically will have, five, six, seven levels of, defaults, that if the first round goes, there's a second computer, third computer. Somehow there's like five or six safety systems built into it, and they go that deep. And it may be that the companies that are doing hybrids may have to go back and look at that maybe they have to have a second computer on board. They have to, they have to start looking at these situations that they never thought might occur. And so that's the problem with, people, pushing the frontier. We're basically into a realm that we 10 years ago wouldn't even have thought about.
Yeah. Well, I still like the car.
Yeah, I mean, there's some very nice people that have had them. Everybody I talk to say they drive very nice.
Yeah, they're a great car to drive, that's for sure. Well, Omar in Manitowoc has a question for you. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about this fiscal karma. I made a reservation earlier when this was being introduced, and after that, as we know, there are many other manufacturers and very cost competitive compared to the fiscal karma. So my question is that, is it worth that money? And my ride one way to my work is about 40 miles or so. And any opinion or rating about the fiscal karma in comparison to the other potential options coming available in the market soon?
Okay, so the karma. And you drive about, Omar, you drive about 40 miles one way to work?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. And main thing is that I want to know the cost. They are talking about mid-$80,000, and I made a reservation, so I have an option to opt out and get my money back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, I guess, you know, that's one I haven't read about yet. Do you have a little more information on that, Omar?
Yeah, this is based in California, a company which is making about, I guess, 1,500 cars, and they had about $500 million, and they were looking for some grants they got from, I guess, some European. And I'm told this facility in San Francisco has some kind of a connection. I don't remember all the details with the Porsche brand, which they do manufacture some parts there. It's totally electric, which also runs on the gas after, I guess, about 50 miles. But main concern was that when I made a reservation for this about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, to be the first one to get the car in the first batch, which is coming in the market sometime in summer this year, and they have their first display in a L.A. auto show earlier this year, I guess, or late last year, I should say. Mm-hmm. And they are asking about mid-$80,000 for this car. Mm-hmm. And they are coming up with a new version, which is a convertible too. So that much I know about it.
Okay, so yeah, I understand what you've described the vehicle very well. What we're seeing now is that this trend for smaller startup companies, because there's enough, we'll say, public support for, you know, not having electric vehicles and such out there, and so we're seeing these smaller companies pop up that are trying to make low volumes, and so then the price is, as you say, $80,000, mid-80s.
Right.
It maybe more than that by the time they try to offer it to you. This sounds, from what you're describing, this basically sounds like the Chevy Volt. It's exactly what the Chevy Volt is supposed to be, and I thought that was going to be available, you know, in the about another year and a half. I thought they were supposed to release that to the public. So I think that will be significantly less expensive.
Now, the other company I can make, if you are familiar with this, Telsa.
Oh, Telsa?
Yeah, I mean, this is Tesla. Compared to
Tesla.
That, I'm saying. Like the Telsa recently, I heard, was going to look for a public trading also, and I think with the market, they pull back that idea.
Tesla.
Just a week ago, too.
Yeah, the Tesla is out of California, and they were actually in position ahead of time to get some of the economic stimulus package. They had actually gone, they had a facility in California, actually had opened a branch in the Detroit region, which subsequently got closed. But the Tesla itself, the first round version of that is an all-electric vehicle.
And right. So if I ask you, assuming if that fiscal is compared to that, and the price range is also very close, so is Tesla, if I ask you, is worth for that money if one is looking for an electric car with that kind of a ride?
Well, the Tesla is basically an electric Corvette. So I just if you're thinking this is, you know, what you're going to go get groceries in and everything, it's not. Basically it's got I think the horsepower, it's like 175 kilowatt motor. So you're in plus 200 horsepower electric driving this thing. So they made it, I mean, they were trying to sell it as a very sporty car, you know, like the world's fastest electric vehicle, and that's kind of what the Tesla was. So the battery pack's fairly large on it, so if you got to go 40 miles and you weren't going to do anything else, you would be able to get, you know, to work and back without recharging that vehicle. So the only thing you might want to look at is, you know, what the recharge time is depending upon what socket you have available in your house. If you're going to just use a conventional 110 outlet, you may not get it charged overnight.
Okay. So, some things to think about. Thank you, Omar, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to Dennis and Toma in just a second. But just to remind you, Glenn Bauer, our guest today, he's a senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to the phones now and talk with Dennis in Toma. Dennis, hello.
Oh, good morning. Hi, Glenn. One of the issues I've been kind of pondering is with the advent of the, not so much the hybrid, but now the full plug-in hybrid and those extended mileage, how are they dealing with the demands of environmental controls within the vehicle? You know, it does get cold here in the wintertime, and you need heat. In summertime, you need air conditioning. And how much does that hit the efficiency and the extended range that they're trying to get from these targets, like, say, the Bolt and their 40-mile target range?
Okay.
Well, first off, is what they're trying to do is and when you normally have an engine, you have waste heat off the engine, so you just basically it's a waste product, so you use it. So you, right. you kind of have to rethink this. That a lot of times it's more efficient to heat the seat directly. So that you know, the air might be cooler, might be 50 degrees, but since the you heat the seat, you can, you know, basically you don't have to use as much energy. I would say that, you know, for cruise speeds, you're probably going to use maybe about 10 kilowatts. You're probably going to, if you're going to run the air conditioning at full load, you're probably going to use 10%. 10 to 15% of your range will be lost due to having the air conditioning or the heating on.
How are they driving the air conditioning? Just electric pump?
Yeah, so basically what they're doing then is they're putting an electric motor, a three-phase electric motor, onto a normal compressor and then operating it that way. So what they can do, though, is they run variable speed, so they can then optimize the efficiency at any amount of cooling the driver demands.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call as well. And on to Tom in Milwaukee next. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a 2005 Prius, and I have had occasional little surge or jerk when I hit a bump. Didn't make much of it till I heard about all this. And I'm wondering if they over-engineered it in the sense of the regenerative braking. Does it really contribute that much to the efficiency? Because when I look at the screen display in my car, I see it charging when I coast or when I'm driving on the road. You know, the gasoline engine is charging the battery. So would they make it less complicated and lose that much by not having the regenerative braking?
Okay, so there's a two-part answer. On the highway, basically the regenerative braking, because you only stop maybe once in 50 miles, doesn't really impact your fuel economy. We've found it's less than 1% in our testing. In the city, though, if you're doing stoplights, we haven't tested the setup that's in the Prius, but we've what we call a parallel hybrid. So we've got the electric mm-hmm. motor and the engine coupled to the road at the same time. We've seen upwards of 25 to 30% fuel economy increase in city driving due to the regenerative system on the vehicle.
So I see. But then maybe it would be, but they're having problems because of the switching back and forth with this. Maybe they should re-examine whether it's worth it.
Part of it is that on these, like I said earlier, is that it's like a fighter jet. The brake pedal is an input to a computer, and it has to decide if it's going to apply the conventional hydraulic brakes or if it's going to apply the electric motor to try to slow the vehicle down. And so there's algorithms in there that have to be calibrated, obviously. So just to say the regenerative braking is the issue, I mean, without looking at a bunch of data and a bunch of reams of paper on you know, some experiments, I wouldn't be able to make a comment to that end. But, I mean, I think the fact is that, you know, they're just here again. They're probably – we're seeing some condition they didn't think about when they calibrated this vehicle, and since they're the edge of the frontier, they're right. The first ones to do it. They're the ones that are discovering these new nuances that everybody else will be the benefactors of.
And when you say regenerative braking, what does regenerative braking really mean?
Well, just think of it as winding a big rubber band up. You mean, everybody had the rubber band car, right? So you sat there with your finger and wound a rubber band up. So what regenerative braking is saying, look, I have energy because I'm moving and I need to stop. Okay. So what we normally do is in a conventional car, we just take some composite pads and we pinch a piece of metal and create a whole bunch of friction, and the friction creates heat. We can't do anything with the heat. We just lose it to the environment. But in these vehicles, we have a motor on board that can act as a generator. So we actually use the motor as a generator, and instead of applying brake pads, we stop the vehicle using resistance via the generator to slow the vehicle down. And so we're basically recapturing energy we'd otherwise just throw away.
Got it. You mentioned the rubber band. What about compressed air? Peter from Fort Atkinson emailed in and had received a web story from a friend that talked about a compressed air engine that was developed by Tata Motors. Sounded too good to be true. Any truth to this possible form of alternative motion?
Well, you know, I wrote an article. Well, I'm dating myself now. I don't even know. For the New York Times one time, there's a guy in Australia that had come up with this compressed air engine. It is a way to store energy. But the problem we have is a gas, when you compress it, gets very hot. That's one of the side effects because it is a gas. And the difficulty is if the gas cools down, we lose that energy. And so because of that, if you can't insulate whatever you're compressing the air into, you lose a lot of energy in the process. And so it's typically a lot less efficient than even a battery or like a hydraulic hybrid.
All right. And a comment from somebody else emailed in. Bill emailed in to say, this goes back to the smart car. Smart car is a rear-wheel drive, so maybe not the best in winter for that other caller.
Well, I grew up with rear-wheel cars, yeah. So, I mean, that's how you did donuts, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Actually, the weight over the back wheels, if you remember the old commercials, what do they drive to get to the snowplow? That was it was a VW commercial. They had the engine over the rear axle. So in a front-wheel car, you actually, as you accelerate, you actually take weight off the front axle. It's the weight transfer of the vehicle. So actually rear-engine vehicles, when you try to accelerate, you transfer artificially some of the weight of the vehicle onto the back axle. So in theory, it should actually have better traction in the snow. But if you're used to a front-wheel drive, you need to retrain yourself because it will act differently.
John in Waukesha, you're up next. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or email at talk@wpr.org. Now on to John in Waukesha. Hi, John.
Well, good morning. I have a question about the perhaps sharing or licensing of the regenerative technologies. I know that there's the recall for the Prius now, and then the Ford Fusion is, I guess they didn't call it a recall, they're doing a customer satisfaction notification or something because of problems with the brakes, the regenerative braking in the Fusion Hybrid. And I own a 2010 Honda Insight that I purchased about 5 weeks ago, and for 4 weeks I've been having the same problem with this apparent loss of braking power acceleration with slow stops. And Honda tells me there's, you know, no problems. My question is there some cross-licensing of technology that's going on? Do you know of?
I know that Toyota had traded a bunch of emission patents with Ford.
Mm-hmm.
For Ford, and I thought most of the patents they were getting rights to were more just the how the transmission itself was mm-hmm. put together and built. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of any of patent exchanges as far as the controls itself, how they're going to do the rudimentary control of the systems.
Okay.
To my knowledge, the Honda, I didn't think the Honda was doing a split parallel design yet. So if that's giving you the same kind of cause and effect as the Toyota, that would be an interesting.
Yeah, I don't relate it to bumps. I relate it to a slow kind of light braking, and when I get under 10 miles an hour, sometimes it's sort of like it seems to pop forward. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can probably address what is occurring there. These electric machines, you have magnetic fields, and so you're basically have a rotating part that you've induced or have permanent magnets in, and then you have to keep changing the magnetic field around the outside of it to have the resistance in the right spot. So if you put it in front of the magnetic field, you resist. If you put it behind, you would push. So at low speeds, what happens is you start switching these fields too slowly, and what will happen is you get this cogging effect. So the electric machine doesn't create a smooth resistance or assist at that point. And so what the engineers have to do then is you have to, we call it ramp it out, phase it out. You have to basically convert from using the electric machine as the braking device into applying the hydraulic brakes. Mm-hmm. And so probably what's happening is you have very light brake pressure. You're getting to a point where they need to take the electric machine off, and maybe you don't have your foot down quite far enough to make the computer say, hey, I need to apply the hydraulic brakes. And so my gut feeling what's happening is the electric machine is just being is taken offline, and it's not replacing it with the hydraulic brakes, so it feels like you're surging forward. But in all reality, probably what's happening is you're not slowing down anymore. Mm-hmm. You're just sort of coasting.
Right, and that kind of makes sense. So it's a calibration issue of what I'm hearing.
Probably.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, John. Joel in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Joel.
Hi, I just wanted to let you guys know I'm driving a smart car in Milwaukee right now. And with Blizzak snow tires on it, it's really no different than our front-wheel drive Volvo. So
you're getting just no problem handling in the snow?
Nope. This is our second winter. Last year without snow tires, it was a challenge. But this year with the snow tires, it's hard to do a donut, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I live in rural Wisconsin, so I commute 25 miles. And I am a very strong proponent of snow tires in the wintertime because with the cutbacks and the county budgets and everything, our roads don't get plowed very often. So, I mean, just night and day difference between just an all-season radial and a design tire for winter driving. So, I mean, if you're a parent and you're really worried about younger drivers, that's one thing you can do for them that doesn't cost a lot of money is to actually invest in some snow tires.
Thank you very much for calling. I was talking to one of the people I work with in my department back across campus, and she's from Canada, and she was lamenting this morning. She says, why don't people hear more people put on snow tires in the winter? Because they all, she said, everybody where I live, we put snow tires on in the winter. So kind of goes along with what you're saying. George and Pembine, we're on to you. Hi, George.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. For what it's worth, my wife and I own a 2005 Prius. We have 155,000 miles on it, and honestly, we have not had any acceleration or braking problems. Saying that, what is your experience or knowledge of the durability of the battery packs? I have heard a couple times that there are a couple taxis out on the West Coast, I think it was Vancouver, that have upwards to 300,000 miles on the battery packs. Have you heard this, or what kind of information can you give me on the durability?
I mean, pretty much these battery packs are designed to not be replaced during the normal lifetime of a vehicle. So I'm guessing that the person in Vancouver that has 300,000 miles on it must be doing a lot of, I don't know if it's taxi cab or right. a lot of road miles or what, but 300,000 is probably beyond what most car companies would actually say their engineering design is for. So if they're getting that type of mileage out of that would be a good test. Now, the real test of the battery is what the driving conditions are, because 200,000 miles of stop-and-go traffic in New York City will test the battery and use the battery much more than 200,000 miles of you driving from New York to L.A. on, you know, an interstate and back. And so it's really kind of what we call the driving mix that you do. And so the car that actually uses, you know, it's using electric a lot and then switching the engine back on and off, It's the number of times you cycle the battery that actually is kind of tells you how long it'll last, not necessarily the number of miles on the vehicle.
So if this is actually true, that these taxi, I heard it was taxi cab drivers out in Vancouver, if that's actually true, then they are being tested pretty severely in that situation.
I would think.
Well, yeah. if Vancouver drives anything like New York, yes, they'd be tested pretty well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. A question from Christine emailed, wondered about the Stirling engine and inventor Dean Kamen's involvement.
Okay, a Stirling engine. It's basically a heat cycle. So what you can do is, with a Stirling engine, a lot of people propose that you could take the waste heat out of the gasoline engine on a vehicle and then, you know, run a Stirling engine and from there run a generator that would charge a battery and then you could use the battery however you want. The trouble is that Stirling engines take a very large space to, you have to have a large volume to create a lot of power out of them. Mm. And so just because vehicles need to be compact for aerodynamics, it's very difficult to fit one on a vehicle to take advantage of that waste heat that you're otherwise throwing away out the exhaust pipe. Now, with that said, is if you cool the exhaust down too far, then the catalyst systems we have won't work, and you won't meet emission regulations. So there's never a simple answer to any of this.
John in Milwaukee says, from what I understand, Warren Buffett has invested in this company. It's called BYD or BID, BYD, I guess it is. I've also read that BYD or BID has a plug-in hybrid for sale today in China, and they're planning to sell a very reasonably priced under 20 grand plug-in hybrid in the U.S. Seen anything on that?
I haven't so far, so I'll have to do a little homework here.
BYD, it said. And I meant it was capital B, capital Y, capital D, so I have to take a look at that. Christopher in Madison, on to you. Hi.
Hello. I want to step back and take a little bit of a devil's advocate view of the whole conversation, and that is with peak oil approaching and the incredible power that exists in a gallon of gasoline, I don't foresee that operating the vast tonnage of movement of materiel and vehicles around the United States, that making and producing electric-powered vehicles is really going to allow us to keep living the kind of lifestyles we have been living. Do you have a comment about that?
I'd probably agree with you. The energy content of batteries right now is on the order of maybe 1/20th to 1/15th of the volume that gasoline takes up. My claim is that there is not one alternative energy that will satisfy the United States. And so with that, the people that live in North Dakota and South Dakota, electric vehicles really aren't going to work.
Yeah.
Because they go too far a distance. But they grow grains, and they can basically make ethanol, and they make biodiesel. They make it right there. They don't have to transport it anywhere. So what we need to do is we need to look at, basically, you have to have areas where electric vehicles would be very useful, and you look at the bigger cities. You need to look at the bigger cities. The problem is some people still drive from the north side of Chicago to the south side of Chicago every day. And if we can get past that, I mean, the electric vehicle theoretically should work in the larger cities for the vast majority of people that are commuting, you know, less than, you know, 20 or 25 miles in one direction. And so I think we need to, or, you know, the fuel cell would be the other one where you can afford to put a hydrogen fueling station in because you just have a lot of people that would utilize it. It's not like, you know, the old commercials where it's a gas station in the middle of the desert, one car pulls up a day. Well, we can't afford to put a hydrogen refueling station in that region of the country. So my contention is, yes, we need to look at all forms of alternative energy and figure out where they'd best be utilized to come up with it's a very complex game plan, I guess.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. Dale in Woodbine, Illinois. Your turn. Hi.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
I'd like to have the opinion of your guests on the future of natural gas
using the
conventional engines we got now, and sort of take away the complexity of these electrics and so forth.
All right. What do you think?
First off, the United States has large reserves of natural gas, so that makes it an excellent excellent candidate. There are foreign countries. I mean, I'm going to India today. Basically, every taxi cab in the larger cities, Mumbai and Delhi, have to use natural gas. All of the buses had to be converted from diesel to operate on natural gas. We still wouldn't have we'd have to develop another infrastructure. So if building on the last one is that we need to make sure that if we're going to, as the government, invest billions of dollars helping develop another infrastructure, that it is the correct solution and just not a knee-jerk reaction. But natural gas is one. One of the problems is that we will start competing for what is normally used as a home heating fuel. And so that could drive up that cost. And so with the sociological issues that will occur because of that. So
there you have it, Dale. Thank you. William in Waupaca, hi.
Yeah, I've got a question that's been bugging me for a long time. I've had the opportunity, and it was a wonderful opportunity, driving a Prius through the mountains. And when you get in the western mountains, you have grades sometimes of 15-20% grade, and they might be as long as 15-20 miles long. And you put the control into the regenerative mode for braking, and it does a wonderful job of retarding the speed of that car going down the mountain. Now, what happens when your battery is recharged? Where does that energy go?
Well, at that point in time, they're converting over and having to use the conventional brakes. So you're just creating heat and you're having to dump it.
We never had to use conventional brakes and nothing ever heated. And that's my question. You're converting, you're slowing down that car and you're taking that energy. And what is happening to the energy?
Well, I'm just saying, did you have your foot in the brake pedal?
Never touched the brake pedal.
Okay.
Matter of fact, there's times when you even have to take your foot and put it on the accelerator to bring the car back up to its cruising speed.
Okay. So the only way that I could foresee that is, I don't think the car had something wrong with it such that it would normally add a huge amount of resistance to it. But they could, with that vehicle, you can cut the fueling and the spark to the engine, and then what you're doing what the semis call a Jake brake. You're basically, you can use the engine as a huge air compressor, and you can dump the heat basically into the exhaust gas going through the engine. Because if you're rolling at highway speeds, the engine has to be spinning, and you could just simply basically take the fueling away from it and have the engine itself then just basically absorbing energy because of the frictional losses inherent in it.
Interesting. Thank you, William, for calling. And Glenn, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by. Have fun in India.
I will.
And we'll see you when you get back. Come back and tell us what you tell us all about your trip and your work with Tata Nana.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Glenn Bauer is senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. He knows a lot, obviously, about hybrids and various fuel technologies, and I appreciate having him with us, and we will get him back, and we will do this again. Coming up, though, we're going to switch gears entirely. You ever get an autograph from someone, baseball player maybe, or a movie star? Wonder what the value is of that. We're going to be talking about autographs and historical documents with a person who has kind of made his life work out of it. Dan Rowe of Tamworth, New Hampshire, joins us next to talk about autographs and historical documents here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.